I want you to picture a scenario. It's a Tuesday morning, typical start to the week.
Oh.
You've got your coffee, the clinic is humming, patients are checking in.
Mm-hmm.
You open the mail, and there's an envelope from the Department of Health and Human Services.
Mm-hmm.
Your stomach just drops. It's a notification of an upcoming HPAY audit.
Right.
Or maybe it's not the government at all. Maybe it's an email from your cyber insurance provider, and it has a renewal questionnaire attached that looks less like a form.
And more like a doctoral thesis on cryptography.
Yeah, exactly.
That questionnaire is the modern nightmare for practice managers. It used to be so simple, a generic checkbox.
Do you have antivirus? Check.
Right. Now, it's a three-page list of demands that feels like it was written in alien hieroglyphics. And if you answer no to the wrong question, your premium doubles.
Or they just drop you entirely.
Or they drop you.
And the stakes are just incredibly high.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't just talking about paperwork here. We've all seen the headlines about medical practices, some right here in our backyard in Orange County.
Oh, yeah.
Getting locked out of their systems by ransomware, patients turned away, surgeries canceled. Total gridlock. It's visceral.
It is. The anxiety is so real because the consequences are tangible. It's not just a fine anymore. It's about business continuity.
If your data is locked up,
your business is effectively closed.
That is exactly why we're doing this deep dive today. We are breaking down the 2026 HPAY IT Compliance Guide and Technical Safeguards Checklist.
Good.
But I want to be really clear right up front. If you're tuning in expecting a lecture on privacy notices or, you know, how quietly to speak at the reception desk,
you're in the wrong place.
Yeah. We're not doing the administrative stuff today.
No. Today is purely about the technical side, the IT systems.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, according to the data we have, this is where the actual failures are happening.
Right.
You can have the best privacy policies in the world, but if your server has a default password, you're vulnerable.
So let's define the scope then. When we say technical safeguards, in the context of these 2026 regulations,
mm-hmm.
what are we actually looking at?
We are looking at the digital fortress. Technical safeguards are the technology and the specific policies that protect EPHI, so electronic protected health information.
Okay, so the patient records in the EHR.
Yes, that, but it's also the emails sent to specialists. It's the backup file sitting on a server. It's the data cached on the receptionist's iPad.
So if it's electronic and it involves a patient,
it falls under this umbrella.
Okay, so it's the entire digital footprint.
Yeah.
Now, looking at the source material, there's a concept that seems to trip everyone up immediately. The guide calls it the flexibility trap.
Right.
The Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, Tanny, they don't just give you a shopping list, do they?
I wish they did. That would make everyone's life so much easier. They don't say, buy Norton antivirus version X and you're safe.
They require what they call reasonable and appropriate measures.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds nice. Sounds like it's cutting you some slack.
It sounds like slack, but it's actually a burden because reasonable and appropriate is subjective until you get audited.
And then it becomes very objective.
Very objective. There's no easy button. You can't just buy a software package and declare yourself compliant. You have to assess your specific risks.
For your specific practice.
Exactly. Whether you're a solo practitioner in Irvine or a massive clinic in Santa Ana, you have to implement technology that matches your complexity.
And that's the kicker. If an auditor shows up, they don't just want to see that you have a firewall.
No.
They want to see the paperwork proving why you chose that specific firewall and proof that it's actually doing its job.
It's the difference between being safe and being compliantly safe. It's not just about security. It's about documented security. You have to show your work.
Okay. Let's get into the gears of this checklist. The first major pillar is access controls. Essentially, who gets through the front door?
Mm-hmm.
And the guide flags a specific behavior as a tier one violation, something I feel like I see in almost every small business, not just medical ones.
Mm-hmm.
Shared logins.
We call this the front desk problem.
Yeah.
You walk into a practice and there are three receptionists. They're busy. Phones are ringing.
Patients are waiting.
Right. And they all use the same computer terminal. And to save time, they all log in with a single username like front desk or admin.
And the password is welcome1.
And everyone knows it.
From a workflow perspective, I get it. It's faster. You don't have to log out and log back in every time you switch seats. But from a compliance perspective,
it's a catastrophe because compliance is based on accountability. if a record is deleted or file is stolen or someone snoops on a celebrity or patient's file.
You have to know who did it.
You have to be able to say who did it. If everyone is logged in as front desk, you have zero accountability. You can't pin it on anyone.
So the rule is absolute, Jen. Unique user identification for everyone.
Absolute. Whether it's the head surgeon, a nurse, or a temp who's there for 2 days to cover a leave, every single human being touching that keyboard needs their own unique ID.
Which brings us to the other side of access, leaving the computer. The source mentions automatic log off. Again, this feels like a user experience nightmare.
Oh, doctors hate it.
I bet. They hate having to log back in constantly.
They hate it, but it's non-negotiable. The standard in the checklist is 15 minutes. If a workstation is inactive for 15 minutes, the screen has to lock.
And when you think about the physical environment of a clinic, it makes sense.
It does. A nurse pulls up a patient's history, gets called away to a code blue, and runs out.
Right.
If that screen stays open, anyone walking down the hall.
A delivery driver, a janitor.
Another patient, they have full access.
It's a huge vulnerability. And 15 minutes seems generous, honestly. In a high traffic area, shouldn't it be less?
Often, yes. In a lobby or a hallway, you might need to set it to 3 to 5 minutes. But 15 is the general ceiling.
Now, let me play devil's advocate here. We lock everything down. Unique IDs, auto logouts, complex passwords. What happens when the power goes out?
Right.
Or the system crashes, or the internet goes down? You can't just say, sorry, can't treat you. The computer says no.
That's the break glass scenario. The checklist mandates emergency access procedures. You need a documented plan for how staff access EPHI during an emergency.
But how do you document that technically? If the server's down, how do you get the data?
It's often low tech or at least redundant tech. Maybe there's a specific high-level emergency account, and the credentials are in a physical, tamper-evident envelope in the office manager's safe.
Okay.
Or a localized backup on a secure, encrypted laptop that doesn't rely on the main server. The key is you have to figure this out before the lights go out.
You can't be inventing policy during a crisis.
No. That is a recipe for disaster.
That's a great point. Okay, let's pivot to the data itself. Encryption. Now, I found this part fascinating because the source uses a very specific, and I have to say, a very confusing term.
Addressable.
Yes. Addressable. It says encryption is an addressable implementation specification. And to a layperson, that sounds like
optional.
Exactly. If you feel like it.
It is probably the most dangerous word in the entire HIPAA vocabulary. In federal regulations, addressable does not mean optional.
So what does it mean?
It means you must implement it unless you can document a very specific technical reason why you can't. A and D, you implement an equivalent alternative that provides the same protection.
So functionally, in 2026, is there any reason not to encrypt?
No, just do it. In 2026, there's rarely a valid technical reason not to encrypt patient data anymore. Modern processors handle encryption without slowing things down.
That old argument is dead.
It died 10 years ago. Yeah. If you try to tell an auditor, we didn't encrypt because it slows down our computers, they will laugh you out of the room.
And the scope here is massive. We're not just talking about the database on the main server.
No, it's data at rest and data in transit. Data at rest means full disk encryption on every single laptop and desktop. And here's where it gets really interesting for you as a listener. Encryption is your get out of jail free card.
How so?
Under the breach notification rule, if a laptop gets stolen from a doctor's car, and this happens all the time.
Oh, all the time.
And that laptop is unencrypted, you have a data breach. You have to notify every patient, the media, and HHS. It's a PR nightmare and a huge fine.
Okay.
But if that laptop isn't encrypted, it's considered a security incident, not a breach.
Because the data is unreadable.
It's mathematically unreadable to the thief. You document it, replace the laptop, and you move on. No letters to patients, no CNN trucks on your lawn.
That alone seems worth the price of admission. That is a massive difference in outcome.
It is. It saves careers.
And what about data in transit?
That's when the data moves. Sending an email, submitting a claim, checking the EHR from home. You need HTTPS for web-based systems and TLS for emails.
Otherwise, it's like sending a postcard.
Exactly. If you're sending patient data over the open internet without encryption, it's like writing a diagnosis on a postcard and dropping it in a mailbox. Anyone along the route can read it.
Okay, let's move to the next section. Audit controls. This feels a bit philosophical. If a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it,
does it still make a sound? In the HIPAA world, if a breach happens and your logs didn't catch it, you're still in trouble. Actually, you're in more trouble.
Because you weren't even watching.
Right. Audit controls are about logging who accessed what, when, and what they did.
But here's the thing. Most systems do this automatically now, right?
Yeah.
Your Windows server logs things, your firewall logs things, the EHR logs everything. So aren't most practices covered?
That is the trap. The source makes a critical distinction. It's not enough to have the logs.
You have to look at them.
You have to look at them. You have to monitor. The requirement is that you must have documented procedures for reviewing those logs.
So you're looking for suspicious activity.
Exactly. Why was a nurse accessing a patient's file at 3 a.m. on a Sunday? Why was there a failed login attempt 50 times in a row from an IP address in Russia?
So if an auditor asks, how do you review your access logs? And your answer is a blank stare.
That's a fail. And I know what people listening are thinking. I'm a small practice. I can't filter through 10,000 lines of code every week.
Exactly. It seems impossible.
It is impossible for a human. That's why you use tools. You use software, often called a SIM, that aggregates these logs and flags anomalies.
So it filters out the noise.
It filters out the noise and sends you an alert only when something looks weird. But you need the process. You need to be able to show that someone is watching the wall.
Speaking of watching the wall, let's talk about authentication. Proving we are who we say we are. We've moved way past just passwords, haven't we?
We have to. The checklist highlights multi-factor authentication, or MFA. Now, here's a nuance. The text of HiPay itself, which was written years ago, doesn't explicitly scream, you must use MFA.
Got it.
But that reasonable and appropriate clause kicks in. In the current threat landscape, using only a password is no longer considered reasonable. And more importantly,
your cyber insurance carrier.
They demand it.
Hey.
Good luck getting a policy renewal in 2026 without MFA. It's required for remote access, absolutely.
For sure, if you're logging in from home.
You need that code on your phone. But increasingly, it's required for accessing the EHR internally and definitely for any administrator accounts. It's that extra layer that stops a hacker even if they buy your password on the dark web.
But passwords aren't gone completely, and I noticed the standards for them have changed. I remember when password 123 with a capital P was considered okay.
Definitely not anymore. The 2026 standards in the guide call for password hygiene. But interestingly, the guidance has shifted from just complexity to length.
Oh, so not just a bunch of random symbols.
Symbols are good, but length is better mathematically. A 15-character phrase like, I love coffee in the morning, is actually harder to crack than P at sword one.
I see.
The guide suggests a minimum of 12 characters, no reuse of old passwords, and crucially, account lockouts.
That's the brute force protection.
Right. If someone tries to guess your password 10 times, the system should lock the account. If it lets them guess a million times, they will eventually get in.
Okay, this next topic is one of my favorites because of the analogy we came up with during prep. Schrödinger's backup.
Ugh, the untested trap. This is where hearts get broken.
You have a backup drive. Mm-hmm. It sits in the corner. The lights are blinking. You think it's working.
You assume it's working.
But until you actually try to use it, you don't know if the data is alive or dead.
And sadly, many practices find out it's dead exactly when they have a ransomware attack. They go to restore, and they realize the file is corrupted or it stopped backing up 6 months ago because the drive was full and nobody noticed.
The requirement isn't just to do backups.
It's to maintain retrievable, exact copies of EPHI.
And the source outlines a pretty rigorous testing schedule for this. It's not just set it and forget it.
No. They suggest monthly verification that the backup just completed successfully, just checking the logs, but then quarterly test restores.
Well, actually trying to pull a file back.
Exactly. Take a sample file, pick a random payment chart from 2022 and try to bring it back. Open it. See if it works.
And annually?
Annually. A full disaster recovery test. Simulate the server dying. Can you spin up the backup? How long does it take? Because if it takes 3 weeks to download your data from the cloud, your business is dead anyway.
And where do we keep these backups? The 3-2-1 rule comes into play here, right?
Yes. Three copies of data on two different media types with one offsite. The critical part for HIP is that offsite or cloud component. If your server is in a closet and your backup drive is sitting on top of that server and the building burns down,
or sprinklers go off,
you've lost everything.
I saw a mention of immutable backups in the guide. What does that mean?
That is a defense against modern ransomware. The nasty thing about ransomware today is it doesn't just encrypt your live data. It goes looking for your backups and encrypts those too.
So you can't restore. It forces you to pay.
Exactly. An immutable backup is one that cannot be changed or deleted for a set period of time, say 30 days even, by an admin. It's a write once, read many lock. it's your failsafe. If everything else burns, that immutable copy is still there, clean and ready.
That leads right into disaster recovery plans. It's not enough to have the data. You need a plan for how to get the business running again.
We'll figure it out when it happens. It's not a strategy. A disaster recovery plan is a written document. If you get hit by ransomware, who do you call? If the facility is inaccessible, how do doctors see patient info? Do you have paper charts as a backup? This has to be scripted out.
Let's talk about the gadgets. Everyone has a phone, a tablet. Device hygiene. This is the whole BYOD problem. Bring your own device.
Mobile device management, or MDM, is huge here. If doctors are using their personal iPhones to check patient charts, that device is now part of your security scope.
That sounds invasive. Telling a doctor you need to control their personal phone.
It's a hard conversation, but necessary. MDM software creates a secure container on the phone. It effectively separates work data from personal data.
So you can enforce security on just that part.
Right, like requiring a passcode just on that app.
Yeah.
There's the remote wipe capability. If a doctor leaves their phone in a taxi, you can send a signal to wipe the patient data container immediately. And importantly, you wipe only the work data. You don't delete their personal photos. That distinction helps with the buy-in.
And what about when we throw things away? Media disposal. I can't just toss an old hard drive in the dumpster out back.
Absolutely not. That is a classic mistake. Deleting a file doesn't remove it. It just removes the reference to it. The data is still there.
Anyone with free software can recover it.
For sure. You need certified destruction, physical shredding of the drive, degaussing, or NIST-compliant digital wiping, and you need proof. The source mentions keeping certificates of destruction.
An auditor will ask for them.
They will literally ask, show me the certificate for the server you retired last year. If you don't have it, you can't prove you didn't just hand patient data over to the local landfill.
This brings us to the overarching theme of this entire guide, the thing that ties every single one of these technical points together, documentation, the show your work principle.
This is where the gap between reality and compliance usually lies. You might have great security, you might have amazing backups, but if you don't have the paperwork, you fail the audit.
It feels bureaucratic, but I guess it's the only way they can verify. What specific paperwork are we talking about?
Everything we just discussed. A policy for access control, a policy for backups, a policy for incident response, but also business associate agreements or BAAs.
Right. These are the contracts with your vendors.
Anyone who touches your data, your IT guy, your cloud backup provider, the shredding company, they all need to sign a BAA promising they will protect the data too.
And if they won't sign?
You can't use them. If you use a generic IT guy who knows computers but won't sign a BAA, you are violating HIPAA just by hiring him.
And the source emphasizes consistency.
Yes. The auditor looks for mismatches. If your policy says, we require passwords to be changed every 90 days, but your computer is set to never expire passwords, that's a violation.
So it's better to have a policy you actually follow.
Exactly. Even if it's a slightly less aggressive policy that you actually follow, it's better than a perfect policy that you ignore.
And risk assessments. This isn't a one and done thing.
No, it's active management. Auditors check dates. If you hand them a risk assessment from 2021, that's a huge red flag. It needs to be annual or whenever you make big changes.
Like a new EHR or moving offices.
Right. It shows you're actively managing security, not just checking a box once.
The source material mentions that a lot of these insights come from experiences with practices right in Orange County, Irvine, Santa Ana. They list some common real-world failures. What stands out to you there?
The former employee issue is a classic. A receptionist quits or is fired. In the chaos of running a practice, nobody tells the IT guy.
So their account stays active.
For months. They could log in from home, steal data, delete appointments out of spite. That's a massive security hole, and it happens constantly. You need a termination checklist that includes disable IT access immediately.
And the ad hoc response.
That's the panic response. People get hacked and they just panic and try to fix it. They reboot servers, they delete files, they try to sweep it under the rug. In doing so, they destroy the forensic evidence.
The evidence that proves whether data was actually stolen.
Right. You need a formal incident response plan that says, stop, disconnect, document, call legal.
So bringing this all together, if I am a listener, a practice manager, maybe it feels overwhelming. There is so much to do. Where do you even start?
The source outlines a clear path. Step one, start with a risk assessment. Don't go buy software yet. You can't fix what you don't know is broken.
Diagnosis before prescription.
Exactly. Step two, prioritize. You can't fix everything overnight. Fix the critical gaps, the things that could cause a massive data exposure like unencrypted laptops or lack of MFA. Fix those first.
Your bleeding arteries.
Right. And step three, build sustainable processes. Make compliance a program, not a project.
And they mentioned getting help.
Yes. Most office managers cannot be IT security experts. It's too complex. Partnering with qualified IT support, someone who actually understands IPATAP and will sign that BAA is often necessary. You need someone who speaks the language.
It really puts into perspective how much work goes on behind the scenes to keep our medical data safe. It's all invisible work until it fails.
It is. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's not just about the government fines. It's about trust. Patients trust practices with their most sensitive secrets.
Their diagnoses, their mental health records.
Their entire history. These safeguards are how we honor that trust.
And there's a provocative thought to leave you with today. We talked a lot about audits and we talked about cyber insurance. By fixing these things, you're satisfying both. But ultimately, ask yourself this. If the power went out right now, and the servers locked up with a red ransomware screen and a stern-looking auditor walked in the front door, could you prove you did everything right? Not just say it, but show the receipts.
That is the question that should keep you up at night until you fix it.
That's all for this deep dive into HIPAA technical safeguards. Thanks for listening and stay secure out there.